Focus on nature, not your equipment with Zeiss SFL binoculars, optimized to be as lightweight and compact as possible. Zeiss SFL binoculars are up to 30% lighter than comparable competitors. And trust me, that's important when you're looking at those warblers at the very, very, very tops of the trees. Visit your local optics dealers or visit Zeiss.com/nature to find a dealer near you. Hello and welcome to the American Birding Podcast from the American Birding Association. I am your host, Nate Swick. Are we in the golden age of bird watching? Kate Wong, writing for Scientific American, believes so in an essay that came out at the end of last month. And to be fair, she makes a very compelling argument. It's one that I've made here in this space probably more than once. The idea being that we are in an age of technological plenty, and the tools at a birder's disposal have never been as plentiful or as useful. More, the community has never been as accessible or as diverse. The birding festival circuit is lively. My social media is certainly crawling with friends attending this week's biggest week in American birding in Ohio, and there are similar festivals in San Diego and South Texas and Florida and Indiana and Maine and more popping up seemingly every year. There are countless books from natural history publishers and general public publishers about birds. There are tours to bird-rich destinations being offered by tour companies beyond those that have ferried birders around for decades. And there is a lot of media attention being given to birds and birding, which I take as a sign of growing general interest in birds and nature, including, of course, Kate Wong's very nice piece that started me off on this digression. But here's my perspective, coming as someone who has been a birder since I was a young person and has been in this community for a few decades now, on whether or not this is a golden age of bird watching. Yes and no. And listening to myself now, I realize that's the sort of equivocation that justifies your rolling eyes, but hear me out. Kate Wong is a pandemic birder, and that's no knock on her. People come to birding for lots of reasons, in lots of ways, at lots of times, and finding birding during the pandemic is certainly a path that is shared by a lot of people, certainly a lot of listeners out there. I hear from people all the time about it. And I think the tools available to novice birders now allow a person like Kate and others to very quickly reach a level of competence and the associated confidence faster, perhaps, than they have ever done before. Is that a golden age? Which to me implies maybe something transient and fleeting. I'm not sure about that, because I remember my own path into birding and the realization that there were people and resources available to facilitate my growing skill and appreciation of birds, bird clubs, bird books, tapes and CDs of bird vocalizations, organizations like the ABA, Young Birder Camps, in my case, Camp Chiricahua, class of 94 in the house. And to me, that felt like a golden age, too. As perhaps it did for people who came to birding in the 70s with the friendly competition of the California and Cape May schools of birding and the initial work on vagrancy and molt and taxonomy and identification challenges and a developing infrastructure for bird chasing and bird listing. That was all new. That was all exciting. Or even back to 1934 and the publication of Roger Torrey Peterson's first bird identification book, which was revolutionary at the time. I actually went back to the ABA's Birding Magazine archive and searched for the term Golden Age and found references to the Golden Age of California birding, the 70s, and the Golden Age of optics, the 90s, hilariously considering what we have now, the Golden Age of citizen science and understanding migration and climate catastrophe, which reminds us that even in our modern Golden Age of bird understanding, the sad truth is that we have fewer birds to look at than any previous generation. I found an editorial comment from Eileen Lotz in a February 1990 issue of Birding that begins, "We live today in a golden age of birding. We have access to every corner of the globe. We still experience the discovery of new species," and on and on. Eileen also points out that birders still have the opportunity to see birds that will sadly become extinct. All things that both wonderfully and sadly are still true. I like to think that each of us has our own golden age, and that it sort of corresponds with the time that we discover birding, because the magic of that discovery, the opportunity to welcome that part of the natural world into our own life, is so powerful and moving that it feels like a global paradigm shift. And that's no knock, again, on Kate Wong, who is 100% correct that the birding world is in a pretty great place right now in terms of connecting people to birds and facilitating that interest. Kate calls it a fixation. She is not wrong. But to me, the best part of that essay is not the argument that technology nurtures this interest, but the narrative of her own experience on the California coast, watching elegant terns and wren tits and yellow-billed magpie, because that part is so resonant to anyone who comes to birding at any part in their life. You know, this opportunity to be present in a moment with these creatures, to know the world is moving along with you and without you, you can connect in this small, present moment. That's the thread that connects Alexander Wilson to Roger Torrey Peterson to Phoebe Snetsinger to David Sibley to Kate Wong. Because it's all a golden age. All we can do is be grateful for it. On the show this week, some might say the golden age of ornithology, at least in North America, was the 18th and 19th centuries, the era of Audubon and Wilson and Ord and Peale, and the many characters that more or less founded American ornithology. A lot can be learned about them by the birds they missed. Why did Caspian tern and Swainson's thrush fly under the radar for so long? Birding legend? Yeah. A legend. Ken Kaufman explores all of this in his new book, The Birds That Audubon Missed. He joins me after this week's Rare Birds. This is your Rare Bird Focus for the beginning of May 2024. There are a lot of birders' eyes on and around the Great Lakes this week, hoping to experience some of the most spectacular migration phenomena the continent has to offer, and frequently, more unusual birds get spotted too. First to Ontario, where the province's first record of white-tailed kite was photographed at Long Point on the north side of Lake Erie this week. This species is widespread across the Americas, but in the ABA area, it is primarily a bird of the southwest and south central regions, but regularly up the Pacific coast as far as Washington as well. As one might expect for such an adept aerialist, this species has a strong pattern of vagrancy north and east, with records as far north as Minnesota and as far east as Rhode Island. And continuing the theme of southwestern birds in the middle of the continent, Wisconsin's first record of varied bunting was seen in Ozaukee County, just north of Milwaukee this week. This species has far fewer vagrant records than white-tailed kite, but birds seen in western Pennsylvania and Ontario, Long Point, coincidentally enough, back in 1995, suggest that it might be more prevalent as a vagrant than records would indicate. Female or young birds in particular could be very easily overlooked. That's all I have this week. For the full list, check out the ABA Rare Bird Alert on Fridays at aba.org/RBA. You can also follow along with all the rare bird news in our ABA Rare Bird Alert group on Facebook and in ABA community. The ambitions, egos, and adventure surrounding 18th and 19th century American ornithology is legitimately fascinating, and many of the characters involved have created legacies that affect birding and bird study to this day. Perhaps there's no better person in the modern birding world to tackle these legacies than author, artist, and naturalist Ken Kaufman, who scarcely needs an introduction to this podcast's audience. His new book, The Birds That Audubon Missed, Discovery and Desire in the American Wilderness, looks at John James Audubon, Alexander Wilson, all their peers through the lens of the common and widespread birds that they did not find and describe, and perhaps should have, rather than the many, many that they did. It asks some interesting questions about how they and we perceive the natural world. Hello, Ken. Welcome. Congratulations on the book. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, thanks so much, Nate. I'm really pleased to hear that.
The last few years have certainly seen an increased interest in the legacies of these early ornithologists. Was this on your mind in the early days of working on this book, or is it sort of a happy coincidence that they both coincided in this way?
It was actually a coincidence, because when I started working on this some time ago, we were still in the phase where most of these early ornithologists were regarded as these spotless heroes who would just be, you know, praised forever. And some of the more controversial aspects of their lives have only come into the headlines in the last couple of years.
and for better, I think that we are sort of taking the sort of larger, broader look at the legacies of these people, because they were, in fact, super influential. They did a ton of amazing work, but I hate using the term men of their time, but there's a lot of aspects of that period in American history that are a bit salacious, a bit controversial, as you say. And certainly these people were no stranger to that sort of part of our history.
Yeah, exactly. And I started into this project just purely looking at the topic from the ornithological side, and became more and more aware of the human aspect of it as I went along. And my opinions of all of these early naturalists continued to evolve as I was going through it. Yeah. I think I have a better idea of them now than I did before. And of course, we can never totally get inside the head of someone who lived 200 years ago, but very, very interesting characters running around in Eastern North America at that time. And I tried to treat all of them fairly. I tried to give them a balanced view.
Yeah, Audubon is particularly difficult, I think, because the myth of Audubon is such a huge part of his legacy. And that was, you know, fomented by his family, his granddaughter, who basically burned all of his correspondence in the hopes of turning, you know, the myth into a bigger story than the man. And, you know, for over a century, she has succeeded. Maybe you should say that she completely succeeded.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Audubon himself did a lot to create the myth of himself. Mm-hmm. He was quite good at public relations.
Yeah, you can say that. That's a generous way to say that.
After a very rocky start and many years of essential poverty, he managed to break out and became hugely successful. Partly because he was so good at reading the public attitude and altering it. And then, as you say, his granddaughter, Maria, helped to burnish the reputation.
burnish all interpretations of the word.
Yeah, by burning many of the original journals and editing them with the help of Elliot Cowes, who was a great ornithologist of the late 1800s. He apparently was complicit in helping Maria Audubon change some of the accounts to make John James Audubon seem more of a hero, more of an ornithologist and conservationist than he was.
Yeah, it must be very difficult to get a read on the man himself, because so much of his life is actively missing.
That's true. Yeah, and the things that he wrote about himself were often contradictory, but often you can sort of get a sense of someone just from that, you know, just reading the stories they tell about themselves, even if they're not true.
Yeah,
they reveal some things.
Yeah, I think the angle here that makes this book particularly interesting, there have been obviously many pages written about these men, and it's almost all exclusively men. What they discovered, what they figured out about the continent's bird life, but much less about what they didn't find, or for whatever reason, and there are lots of reasons, or what they got wrong. I think it offers a much fuller picture of their respective legacies, and certainly makes for a very interesting narrative. Have these questions about what they missed been in your head for a while?
Yes, they have, and that was really what brought me into this topic in the first place. More than 10 years ago, I was going through all of Audubon's paintings for Birds of America, just reviewing them for work on the National Audubon Society website. And what really caught my attention was Swainson's thrush. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very common bird. I mean, birders know. You see, if you're out at all during spring and fall migration, especially in the eastern half of the continent, there are lots of Swainson's thrushes going through. And just seeing that Audubon never painted that got me to thinking. I was thinking, what's this? You know, how could it have been missed? And then started looking further, going through and trying to list out, okay, Kirtland's warbler, it's a rare bird, it hadn't been discovered yet, but Caspian tern, you know, how did he miss Caspian tern? And so that, you know, I sort of came into it through the back way.
Yeah.
Just, you know, through the storeroom or something, to the subject of, okay, what was happening as these guys were running around discovering these birds, discovering them and describing them to science under the Linnaean system? What was the process they went through, and how did that lead to them missing or misinterpreting some of those birds?
You certainly talk about the thrushes, for instance. Shorebirds may be less surprising given the issues that even modern birders have with them. You know, they didn't have the optical tools that we sort of take for granted, and that plays a role, certainly. But they did have something maybe more useful, like, you know, a shotgun that, you know, put these birds literally in their hands, and that they still missed a lot of these clues. You write a little bit about, or a lot about, you know, why this is, but is it sort of a perception issue? Like, you see what you expect and you don't see what you don't expect? Because it feels like people were talking about thrushes. Catesby, you write about Catesby kind of calling all the small brown thrushes just little thrush, and not really taking the time to work through them. But when I look at, you know, something like a gray cheek thrush and a veery, like on opposite ends of sort of the brown spectrum, the differences seem quite obvious to me. And the fact that Audubon and Wilson and Catesby and all these guys missed that, just completely missed that, or weren't interested in it because it wasn't low-hanging fruit, just seems so bizarre to me, as it must to you.
It does. Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think it's partly what you said. People see what they expect to see. And partly there's the sense that your predecessors may have sort of established what's out there. So, you know, Catesby said there was one little brown thrush, and cautiously later in the 1700s, others were willing to say, well, there are two. You know, wood thrush is different from this other. And by the early 1800s, Wilson and others were saying, well, no, actually there are three, you know, because the hermit thrush, you know, it's got this reddish brown tail, and so it looks different from the little thrush. And but you, if you have a bunch of these, if you don't have them sorted out into groups, you have thrushes just sitting out there or lying on the table. They never developed long series of specimens at the time, partly because of difficulties with preserving specimens. And they'd shoot the birds. They'd, you know, like Audubon would keep one that looked really good so he can use it as a basis for the painting, and he'd eat the others, you know. but the, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned veery and gray-cheeked thrush, and it's true that if you have them out in good light, they look really different in terms of color. But you get them back into the deep shadows.
Yeah, fair enough.
And, you know, in black and white, or in, when they're in shades of gray, those two species look pretty similar.
Yeah.
In fact, it's quite possible that the bird that Audubon painted that was presumed to be a veery may have been based on a gray-cheeked thrush specimen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, if you don't think it's out there, it's hard to notice that it's there.
Yeah, it's funny how they course corrected, or the ornithologists almost course corrected later in the 19th century when the subspecies became sort of in vogue. And every subtle little difference became a brand new subspecies. So it's like they swung wildly from this direction of all these sort of birds that were seem very different to us now are one species. And then 50 years later, you're talking about all these slightly different species that we would recognize as just variation among individuals of one species are suddenly getting all these brand new names. So I'm not sure what was going on there, but it's almost like they definitely went too far in the other direction.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Going to extremes. I mean, Harry Oberholzer, you know, practically every marsh in Texas, he described the yellowthroats there as a different subspecies.
Exactly. So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, even Audubon did it too, like thinking black-throated blue warbler, which admittedly is the males and females are quite different. Like the females and young males are like a different species than the brightly colored males. It's wild. They're the blind spots that they had when they were looking at these birds, but maybe understandable given that they had no context for these things.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the warblers, I wrote at great length about the warblers in the book because they were problematic for a number of reasons. At that time, the well, the whole concept of bird families wasn't really in vogue yet. It wasn't part of the original Linnaean system. So thinking of the North American warblers as a family wouldn't have entered their heads until sometime in the 1820s when Charles Bonaparte started using that term more. So Wilson was arguing about, okay, well, is this, you know, some people think that this American redstart is a warbler, but it's obviously a flycatcher.
Yeah, and I mean, I think about the redstarts I've seen, that is not a leap.
That's right. I mean, they do catch flies. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're very good at it.
they're excellent fly catchers. Yeah. And with the black-throated blue warbler, you know, that was Alexander Wilson tended to be quite careful about things, but warblers really screwed him up. I mean, you know, the bay-breasted warbler in fall plumage,
yeah,
he named it a species.
Who among us? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. He named it the autumnal warbler. And he was really confused about why he couldn't find that bird in spring. But the female black-throated blue warbler Wilson described as a species he'd called the pine swamp warbler. Mm-hmm. And he'd only seen, you know, a couple of individuals. But that sort of reveals something about Audubon and his sense of competition mm-hmm. with Wilson, because he went to what he thought was the same place and said, oh, I found a bunch of pine swamp warblers and I found a pair of them with their nest in August, you know. And you don't have, there are not pairs of female black-throated yeah. blue warblers, and they're not nesting as late as August. So,
yeah,
you know, just over and over, you know, Audubon sort of shot himself in the foot that way by claiming to have found things that would have been totally impossible.
It's the work of Matthew Haley, who gets, you know, mentioned quite a few times, and who has also been a guest on this podcast talking about his bird of Washington. I'm glad that stuff has made it into these books and sort of out of the realms of scientific papers, because I mean, in addition to being such a absolutely wild story, it really does reveal a lot about the competitive nature of Audubon and the way in which he went about his business trying to sell this book, which under the circumstances maybe I understand, but boy, it's a lot. It's hard to argue away some of the things that he said and did in the interests of you know, moving paper, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, Matthew Haley has been doing amazing work on the history, and it continues. He continues to dig out these old sources and revise our knowledge. And I was lucky to be able to include some of his findings in the book. His expose of the Bird of Washington is fabulous. I'm hoping that Matthew will write a book of his own at some point. He's done some great work on the background of Charles Wilson Peale, and we're going to be seeing that become public quite soon, and that's going to change our sense of the early days of ornithology too. So Matt's been he's been an amazing pioneer in this field, and I was really blessed that he was willing to share some of his unpublished work with me. I was able to include some things in here that, you know, haven't been in books for the public before.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this stuff must have come along at some point in the midst of your writing this book. Was it easy to fit this sort of in the narrative that you were trying to tell, or did you have to reevaluate the story that you were telling in light of this new information?
Well, the story I was telling kept evolving and changing as I was working on it. But fortunately, I'm such a disorganized writer that I never start at the beginning of something and write through to the end. It's always just a whole bunch of pieces and, you know, hundreds of little fragments of things until they finally coalesce into chapters. And so it wasn't that hard for me to keep changing my opinions and adding in different facts and altering things, and you know, right up to the last, I was going in and moving some things around. So, you know, there's probably some stuff in there that isn't true that'll come out. You know, that things that are inaccurate that'll come out after publication. But that's sort of the nature of the topic.
Yeah,
yeah. But in my case, they weren't intentional.
Yeah, there you go. Another aspect of this book, equally important to the investigation of early ornithology, is your own effort to paint the birds that Audubon missed in an Audubonian style. What did you learn about the man that you think you only could have picked up by attempting to imitate to whatever extent possible his artistic style.
Well, that was a really interesting journey for me. I've done a lot of drawing and painting of birds, but in recent years, I'd mostly been doing oil paintings and doing sort of light and shadow effects, and not the kind of close, detailed watercolors that Audubon did. And one thing that really became apparent to me when I tried to copy his style was that he was really an extraordinary artist. Whatever else you might say about him, his ability and genius really as an artist was extraordinary. So I couldn't totally copy his methods because I couldn't go out and shoot birds and pin them up against a board. But
generally frowned upon these days.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, it's frowned upon these days. But I tried to follow. I tried to emulate the approach that he had. Everything's at eye level. Everything is life-sized. There's pretty much equal lighting on everything with just a trace of shadow to make things more more three-dimensional. And there's always, or almost always, a wonderful composition.
Yeah.
Toward the end of his work, some of his compositions were just really crowded because he was trying to get more birds in. But one thing, you know, I found that I could not. I tried for a long time, some of these paintings I did over and over, but I could not match Audubon's work. You know, my best attempts were maybe up to the level of his worst.
Yeah. You really understand how the book that he produced took the world by storm when you look at some of those images, because they're just so vivid. Like, they're just so full of life. And as you say, like, whatever you can say about Audubon, the man, the scientist, Audubon, the artist, was truly an absolute phenomenon. And you can see, compared to some of the stuff that came before, the work of Wilson and Catesby, which almost seems, you know, childlike in comparison, Audubon is just so vivid. And it's incredible work, no doubt.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was the reason for his success. I mean, as when he was writing about birds, he wasn't nearly as good a scientist as Wilson had been. You know, his observations weren't necessarily as accurate as Bartram's or Catesby's, but the artwork just sort of swept everything else away. And sort of surprisingly, even with that, he wasn't able to achieve much success in the United States. He was searching for publishers, and he got on the bad side of the scientists in Philadelphia, who were all they were all big fans of Wilson, who had passed away earlier. Yeah. But they really didn't think much of his work, and so finally, in desperation, he goes to England, sort of a last Hail Mary attempt, and he gets there, and you know the people there don't know about some of the stuff he's done to fudge some of his bird data, and they just look at the paintings, and it's like, you know, suddenly he's a rock star. Everybody there, you know, he comes in, he's sort of dressed for the frontier, you know, the American woodsman, and everybody wanted to meet him, and the scientists and members of the nobility and wealthy merchants and so on, they all just welcomed Audubon and said, yeah, wow, look at these, you know, these wonders from the wilderness of America. And they had no problem believing that there was this gigantic eagle there that everyone had missed before Audubon discovered it. And if he had succeeded in finding a publisher in the United States, he probably wouldn't have been as successful as he was by going to England.
One of the things that I found most interesting and that I learned about Audubon and his book was that he was pretty much only responsible for the birds themselves, at least, you know, maybe not early on, but certainly later on. So much of the peripheral images, the landscapes, the plants, etc., were done by collaborators, and that's not to say he was wrong to do so. It's for such a huge work that seems at least somewhat necessary. But it's striking to me that so many of these people are, if not forgotten, maybe ignored a little bit. But when I think of Audubon's plates, those aspects, the background, the plants, they're often as stunning as the birds themselves, and certainly heighten the visual impact. of the paintings. Did you feel any sort of obligation to collaborate with people in your own paintings?
Well, I thought about it. It would have made it a lot easier.
That's okay. Well, that's why he did it, certainly.
Yeah. What would John James do? Yeah.
Yeah.
But at that time, in the 1800s and earlier, it was quite common for master artists in Europe to have like a whole team of assistants in the studio who would do a lot of. So it wasn't, there was nothing unethical about it. And frequently, great artists in Europe, they would do some painting and much of it would be done by assistants who would never be named or credited. Yeah. And, Audubon never attempted to keep it a secret that he had these assistants. But, you're quite right. You look at some of these things like Black-billed Cuckoo, one of the early ones, and all the plant life in there is done by Joseph Mason. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. It's wonderful. It's at least as good as the birds.
Yeah.
But something that makes it easier for me to accept that is that there are also paintings where Audubon did all of the plant life, did all the background, and those are amazing as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are some later ones where Maria Martin did the plants, like the flowers in the painting of Bachman's Warbler, for example. Maria Martin did those, but Audubon had taught her botanical illustration earlier. He'd mm-hmm. given her lessons on how to paint plants, and he did give her credit for it. So it's fascinating. You could say he could have done all of those himself.
Yeah.
But it would have taken a lot more time.
Anyway, this was a subscription model too. So he had a timeline. He had a deadline, I should say. To getting these things out in time for her to meet his obligations to his subscribers. So you sort of understand why he did it. Maybe it's just, as you say, Audubon was, happy to let people know that he had collaborators, but maybe it's just Audubon's, the enormous shadow that he casts in bird art that a lot of those people are sort of forgotten over period. Because I certainly didn't know, and I was happy to read that.
Yeah, well, Audubon, he casts quite a shadow in several directions, and that's
there you go.
One of the things that became obvious to me was that a lot of the other people who were active in the early 1800s are overlooked partly for that reason. Hmm. Like I hadn't really thought much about Alexander Wilson before. He's sort of this gray figure in the background who did an ornithology book.
Has a lot of birds named
once.
After him. Yeah,
yeah, but he was really quite the guy. He'd been quite the rebel in Scotland. He was protesting against the unfair treatment of mill workers in Scotland. And he got thrown in jail because the mill owners were so powerful there. He finally comes to America and after several years decides that, well, I think I'll do this book on American ornithology. And within a few years, he's correcting mistakes that had been made by the top biologists in Europe. And going out and carefully discovering and documenting things and writing really colorful descriptions. Mm-hmm. He was an amazing character who's often, he's an Audubon's shadow.
Yeah.
And so, others, George Ord made the mistake of being a critic of Audubon. And, decades later, it becomes obvious that all his criticisms were accurate. Everything right. He criticized, he was right. But, he got on the bad side of the famous guy. And so he's sort of just, treated as sort of this villain in the background.
Yeah. It is interesting. I feel like, for the most part, the birding and ornithological world is sort of less combative, maybe. Certainly, maybe some listeners will disagree with me. There's certainly egos and ambition now, but reading the letters and essays that are left behind by people like Wilson and Ord and Audubon, I'm frequently struck by the sort of basic questions like, would I like these people on a personal level? Because like Alexander Wilson, for all his accomplishments, was so caustic and so sarcastic, sometimes very funny. But, you feel like that might get old. Or, and Audubon was almost so like obnoxiously self-promotional. And maybe that some of that is necessary given what he was trying to accomplish. And maybe it was emphasized by the way that people wrote back then. I don't know. But if George Ord was so annoyed with him, maybe there's some truth there. But after all this work of putting together these books and sort of being in the conversations between all of these people, you know, what is your relationship with them now? Has it changed at all?
I feel like I have a more three-dimensional view of these characters yeah. now than I used to. I started into this sort of assuming that anything that Audubon wrote in his lengthy ornithological biography, you know, five huge volumes, I sort mm-hmm. of assumed that things there were accurate, aside from a few sort of mysterious and puzzling lapses. But after I'd gone through, you know, reading, you know, you can read all these accounts by these yeah. early, they're all available online now, and easy to find. After reading all of them, I sort of switched to the assumption that with Audubon, anything he writes, you have to take it with a grain of salt, unless yeah. it's confirmed by some other source. While on yeah. the other hand, Wilson, you know, anything, he made some mistakes, but he was just so careful and so honest that, you know, if he made a mistake in one volume, he'd try to correct it in the next one. And then Thomas Nuttall, you know, he's mostly famous as a botanist, but he wrote an American Ornithology, and you go through it, and it's like, for some of the species accounts, it's just straight paraphrase from Wilson. Like, one paragraph after another is just paraphrased from what Wilson wrote. And you think, wait a minute. I mean, he did some, you know, I mean, not all. He discovered the olive-sided flycatcher. He was the first to really understand the veery and its behavior. But, you know, also he was good at paraphrasing. But one thing that really strikes me about most of these characters is that after Catesby, most of them ignored Native Americans and their knowledge. Mm. I mean, Catesby ran around with, you know, he got to join Cherokee hunting parties in the Southeast and learn from the people there. But later, I mean, Wilson paid no attention at all to Native American knowledge. You know, admittedly, by that time, you know, Wilson was in Philadelphia. Most of the indigenous tribes had been driven out to the periphery, so it was hard to even find that indigenous wisdom to even ask about. But it seems like any of these people in that era, if they had made more of an attempt to talk to Native American tribes, they could have corrected some of their mistakes before they made them.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, their relationship with indigenous peoples, and it's certainly, you know, a at best a blind spot, at worst sort of a black spot on their legacies. I think in the last couple of years, we've seen a lot written about these men, and a lot of it sort of has something of an agenda. And I mean, perspectives that sort of overemphasize both their brilliance to the point of maybe hagiography, or their shortcomings in a way that feels maybe like a hit job. I do appreciate very much the fact that you are fair to them in this book, but also unflinching of their shortcomings. With all the talk about eponyms, I know you've been a vocal supporter of the effort to remove those, and the opposing view that honorifics are sort of an important way to memorialize the efforts of these people. How would you like to see these individuals remembered?
I'd like to see all of these historical characters seen in a more three-dimensional way, and not... Mm-hmm. You know, we've got such a tendency to put people off into these categories of being either heroes or villains. Mm-hmm. And it's really unrealistic. And we do it in the present day, too. I mean, someone is widely admired until something comes out about them, and then they're just shunned and reviled. Yeah. And it seems like, you know, we're all human, and people who do great things sometimes do terrible things as well. And mm-hmm. I would like to see American society come around to being able to accept that. I think there are various ways to honor people who have contributed to science. And, you know, I'm just looking at the field of ornithology here and birding, but naming birds after people is sort of a faint way to do that. Not very effective. There are people who really had a huge impact on ornithology who don't happen to have any birds named for them. And, you know, there's nothing named for Peel, for Catesby, for Bartram. And on the other hand, you know, there's this warbler named for Elliot Cowes' little sister who never did a thing for birds. It's just so uneven. And I recognize that this is really a controversial topic now. And I think it's worth continuing to debate it and listening. It's worth listening to all sides. Mm-hmm. But there's a major side there that had never been heard at all until very recently. You know, the very idea of having this bird that's common in the South, Bachman sparrow, you know, named for an enslaver who used scripture to try to justify slavery. I mean, what kind of an insult is that? I think we, I think we need to listen to all sides in any discussion of this.
Yeah, it is interesting how the bird had a regularly used and commonly used name. Until Audubon came along and decided that he was going to name it after Jan Bachman, and his book became so famous that that became the name. It's funny how these things, which in their time maybe seem sort of innocuous, have these ripples that cast out towards, you know, 21st century ornithologists that we're having to you know, reckon with a lot of this stuff. And it's, I think it's very important for us to get all these stories in places where people can read them. And I think it's part of what makes your book so interesting and so timely, even if it wasn't, you know, intentionally meant to be that way.
Well, thanks. Yeah. It's coming out at an interesting time. And I have to say the book itself doesn't go into the whole issue of eponyms very much. I address it toward the end as something that, you know, this is a debate that's going on now. And some of these names may change, but I didn't really get into the weeds about arguing one side of the or the other. But I think that knowing more about these historical characters will make it easier for people to think about them, to be informed about the issue. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to hear about some new issue and immediately take sides without knowing anything about it. And I think it would be much better to, when a new initiative comes up, to think about it and sort of reserve judgment and learn more about the subject before jumping into it. And so I'm hoping that the people will learn things by reading my book. I know I learned a ton in the process of writing it. The research was a huge eye opener for me, and it took a long time, but I hope that what I distilled in the pages of the book is going to be informative and helpful for people.
Ken Kaufman's new book, The Birds That Audubon Missed, Discovery and Desire in the American Wilderness, is excellent and important, I'd say, right now. Do check it out wherever you prefer to find your books. Thank you so much for your time, Ken. I really enjoy chatting with you.
Well, it's always great to talk with you, Nate. Thanks very much.
The American Birding Podcast is brought to you by the American Birding Association. Don't forget to join the ABA. If you enjoy the American Birding Podcast, you'll be eligible for a lot of fantastic benefits, including our magazines, all our online stuff like the magazine archives. You can search for Golden Age too, and the new identification portal, and of course, discounts to partners like OM Systems, Media Books, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and many more. Special shout outs this week to Matthew and Steph Davies of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Andrea Walker of Abbeville, Mississippi, all of whom recently joined the ABA and noted this podcast as a reason for doing so. Thank you so much, and welcome to the ABA. Executive Director of the ABA and Executive Producer of the American Birding Podcast is Wayne Klockner, who is publishing evidence of a scandalous tale of the secret marriage of one of Alexander Wilson's good friends, known as the Wilson's Palelope. Technical production is by John Lowry, who heard tell of a time that Thomas Nuttall and William Gamble almost came to blows in a disagreement that resulted in Nuttall throwing a fake punch and causing William to flinch in an incident still known as Gamble's Quail. Additional help comes from Maggie Fitzgibbon and Greg Neese, who read about the time William Alexander Hammond left his collecting party to relieve himself in a nearby copse of trees, only to be called back quickly when a presumed new species was observed, resulting in the ugly incident early naturalists refer to as Hammond's Flycatcher. You can find us online at aba.org, on social media most everywhere as American Birding Association. On Blue Sky, we are at ABA Birds. Questions, comments can come to podcast@aba.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Nate Swick. Bird Like Tom. We'll see you next week.